If it parted, and it seemed almost certain to, the Wills would fall off into the trough of the sea and be swamped long before her crew could beat the ice off the sail and hoist it. All the boats were thick with ice, but the Wills was weighted down like a log. The seas poured on board her, flowing over the pile of sleeping bags in the bow, and leaving them sheathed in ice. Ice formed in masses around the bow as she dipped into each sea, weighting her down that much more, so that every half hour, or oftener, men had to be sent forward to beat the ice off her bow, lest she go under. Finally, for all the party, there was thirst. They had left the pack so abruptly and unexpectedly that they had failed to take on board any ice to be melted into water. There had been nothing to drink since the previous morning, and the men were beginning to crave water desperately. Their mouths were dry, and their half-frostbitten lips began to swell and crack. Some men, when they tried to eat, found it impossible to swallow, and their hunger brought on seasickness. Chapter 4. Toward 3 a.m., the wind began to fall, and by 5 o'clock it had dropped to a gentle breeze. Gradually, the sea grew calmer. The sky was clear, and finally the sun rose in unforgettable brilliance through a pink mist along the horizon, which soon melted into flaming gold. It was more than just a sunrise. It seemed to flood into their souls, rekindling the life within them. They watched the growing light quenching the wild, dark misery of the night that now at last was over. As the sun climbed a fraction higher, they saw off the starboard bow the peaks of Clarence Island, and a little later, Elephant Island, dead ahead, the promised land no more than 30 miles away. In the joy of that moment, Shackleton called to Worsley to congratulate him on his navigation, and Worsley, stiff with cold, looked away in proud embarrassment. They would land by nightfall, provided that not a moment was lost. Shackleton, impatient to be on the move, gave the order to get underway immediately. But it was not that simple. The light of dawn revealed the results of the night. Many faces were marked by the ugly white rings of frostbite, and almost everyone was afflicted with salt water boils that gave off a grey, curd-like discharge when they broke. McElroy called to Shackleton from the Wills that Blackborough's feet apparently were gone, because he had been unable to restore circulation in them, and Shackleton himself looked haggard. His voice, which was usually strong and clear, had grown hoarse with exhaustion. Both the Docker and the Wills were severely iced up inside and out. It took more than an hour to chip away enough to make them fit for sailing. When it came time to haul in the sea anchor, Cheatham and Holness leaned over the bow of the Docker, trying to untie the icy knot in the rope, with fingers so stiff they could hardly move. While they worked, the Docker rose to a sea, then pitched downward. Holness failed to pull his head away, and two of his teeth were knocked out on the sea anchor. Tears welled in his eyes, rolled down into his beard, and froze there. The two men gave up trying to untie the sea anchor. They cut it loose, and brought it, ice and all, on board. The oars were frozen to the sides of the boats, and had to be broken free. The men then tried to knock off their coating of ice, but two of them remained so slippery that they slid through the oarlocks and fell overboard. Fortunately, the Caird managed to retrieve one, but the other drifted away. The boats were finally underway at 7 o'clock. A ration of nut food and biscuits was issued, but the men's thirst was now so intense that few of them could eat it. Shackleton suggested that they try chewing seal meat raw in order to swallow the blood. Pieces of the frozen meat were quickly handed out, and after several minutes of chewing and sucking, the men obtained enough of the bloody juice so they could at least swallow. But they went at it so voraciously that Shackleton realized the supply would soon be exhausted. So he ordered that the seal meat be given out only when thirst seemed to be threatening the reason of any individual. The sails were set, and they put out the oars and rowed at the same time, aiming for the west edge of Elephant Island to offset the gentle southwest wind that was blowing. In the Docker, both Macklin and Greenstreet took off their boots and found their feet frostbitten. Greenstreet's much worse than Macklin's. Surprisingly, Ord Lees offered to massage Greenstreet's feet. He worked over them for a long time, then he opened up his shirt and placed Greenstreet's half-frozen feet against the warmth of his bare chest. After a while, Greenstreet began to feel pain as the blood flowed back into the constricted vessels. Hour after hour they rowed, and the outline of Elephant Island slowly grew larger. At noon, they had covered almost half the distance. By 1:30, they were less than 15 miles away. They had had no sleep for almost 80 hours, and their bodies had been drained by exposure and effort of almost the last vestige of vitality. But the conviction that they had to land by nightfall gave rise to a strength born of desperation. It was pull or perish, and ignoring their sickening thirst, they leaned on their oars with what seemed the last of their strength. By 2 p.m., the snowy 3,500-foot peaks of Elephant Island rose steeply out of the water dead ahead, probably no more than 10 miles off. But an hour later, the island was still in the same position, hanging there, no closer and yet no farther away. Row as they might, they were standing still, apparently caught in a strong tidal current setting offshore. The wind had shifted to the north, so they were also bucking a headwind, and the sails had to be lowered. Shackleton, who was becoming progressively more anxious to get the party ashore, called the boats together and had them made fast one behind the other, with the docker in the lead. He seemed to think it would increase their speed. It didn't. About 4 o'clock, the wind swung around to the west. Hurriedly, they took in their oars and hoisted sail, trying to beat up into the wind. But for the Wills, it was an impossible task, so the Caird had to take her in tow. They made almost no headway against the current. Toward 5 p.m., the wind fell off. Immediately they took to the oars once more and pulled frantically in the gathering dusk, hoping to make a landing before night. But half an hour later, the wind suddenly sprang up out of the west-southwest, and within 15 minutes it was blowing nearly 50 miles an hour. Worsley brought the docker alongside the Caird. Screaming to make himself heard above the wind, he told Shackleton he thought it would be best if the boats separated, to try to make land independently along the southeast shore of Elephant Island. Shackleton, for once, agreed to the separation. At least, he granted Worsley permission to proceed independently. The Wills, however, was kept fast astern of the Caird, and Shackleton admonished Worsley to do everything in his power to stay within sight. It was dark by the time the docker cast off. The island was close, but just how close was impossible to tell. Maybe 10 miles, probably less. High in the sky was a ghostly pale white image, the light of the moon shining through the clouds and reflecting back up from the glaciers on the island. It was all they had to steer by as the boats pounded forward into the cross sea. At times the wind was so strong that they had to let go the lines holding the sails to avoid capsizing. The men in the Caird crouched low to escape the driving spray. But in the docker, and especially the Wills, there was no escape. Those who were steering took the worst punishment of all, and about 8 o'clock the strain began to tell on Wilde, who had been at the Caird's tiller for 24 hours without relief. Shackleton ordered McNeish to take over, but the carpenter himself was very nearly exhausted. After about half an hour at the tiller, though the icy wind tore at his clothing and the spray stung him in the face and soaked him through, McNish's head slumped forward, and he fell asleep. Instantly, the Caird stern swung to leeward, and a huge wave swept over them. It awakened McNish, but Shackleton ordered Wilde to resume the helm. Their immediate goal was the southeast corner of the island. Once around that, they would have the protection of the land. Then they could look for a place to beach the boats. About 9:30, the reflection in the sky looked very close, and they knew they were almost on top of the land. But then, inexplicably, they began to lose ground. Looking over the sides of the boats, they could see that they were travelling rapidly through the water. Yet ever so gradually, the land was slipping from their grasp. There was nothing to do but push on. About midnight, Shackleton glanced to starboard and saw that the docker was gone. He jumped to his feet and peered intently across the stormy waters. But there was no sign of her. Anxiously, he ordered the candle in the compass binnacle lighted, and then had the binnacle hoisted up the mast so that it shone on the cared sail. But no answering light appeared in the distance. Shackleton called for a box of matches. He instructed Hussey to light one every few minutes and hold it so that it flared against the sail. One at a time, Hussey struck the matches as Shackleton peered into the darkness. Still, there was no signal from the docker. But she tried to answer. She was hardly more than half a mile away, and her men had seen the cared signal in the dark. On Worsley's instructions, they took their only candle under the tent cloth and lighted it. Then they tried to hold it so that its light would show through the canvas in reply to Shackleton's signal. But the reply was never seen. A moment later, all thought of trying to signal the cared was forgotten, as the docker suddenly lurched violently in the grip of a fierce tide rip. Worsley was barely able to keep control of the boat. The crew hurriedly took in the sail and even unstepped the mast, which threatened to snap off in the wildly pitching boat. They put out the oars and tried to hold her steady by rowing. One moment she collided with a solid, unseen wave, then the water opened beneath her and she dropped into a dark chasm. Worsley ordered Ord Lees to take up an oar, but Ord Lees begged to be let off, claiming that he was not a fit rower for such a perilous time, and that it was too wet for him. The two men screamed at one another in the darkness, and from every corner of the boat men cursed Ord Lees. But it was no use. Finally, Worsley disgustedly waved him forward. Ord Lees immediately crawled into the bottom and refused to move, even though his weight unbalanced the boat. Greenstreet, Macklin, Kerr, and Marston were at the oars, and they had about reached the limit of their endurance. After a time, Worsley decided to risk hoisting sail again. He swung the docker into the teeth of the wind, holding her as close to it as she would go, so that they were taking the seas more or less head-on. He put all the skill of 28 years at sea into holding her in that delicate position, but she was very nearly uncontrollable. Furthermore, she was becoming sluggish under her increasing burden of water. Ord Lees, who had been lying in the bottom, sat upright. He seemed suddenly to realize that the boat was sinking, and he grabbed a pot and began to bail. Cheatham joined him, and together they worked furiously, hurling the water over the side. In time, the docker rose again to the seas. It was now about 3 o'clock, and Worsley himself began to fail. He had faced the wind so long that his eyes refused to function properly, and he found it impossible to judge distance. Try as he might, he could no longer stay awake. They had been in the boats now for 5.5 days, and during that time almost everyone had come to look upon Worsley in a new light. In the past, he had been thought of as excitable and wild, even irresponsible. But all that was changed now. During these past days, he had exhibited an almost phenomenal ability, both as a navigator and in the demanding skill of handling a small boat. There wasn't another man in the party even comparable with him, and he had assumed an entirely new stature because of it. Now, seated at the tiller, his head began to nod. Macklin saw him going and offered to take over. Worsley agreed, but when he tried to go forward, he found that he could not straighten out his body. He had sat for almost 6 days in the same position. MacLeod and Marston came aft and pulled him out of the stern, dragging him over the seats and cases of stores. Then they laid him down in the bottom of the boat and rubbed his thighs and stomach until his muscles began to loosen. But by then, he was asleep. Greenstreet, too, had taken a moment's exhausted rest, but now he awoke and took over the tiller from Macklin. Neither of them had any idea where they might be, but they shared the same dread as everybody else, the open sea. Between Elephant and Clarence Islands, there is a gap about 14 miles wide, beyond which lies the Drake Passage. The last time the boats had been sure of their position was at dusk, when Elephant Island lay only about 10 miles away. But since then, the wind had been out of the southwest, straight toward that fateful gap.